Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
What's the date today? The 20th of December, 2015. It's about 11:25, and we're here at Paradox's class in beautiful Sierra Madre, California. And I'm Mark Perez. Thank you. Last time we were here was a week ago. Imagine that, a weekly class, and we were here a week ago. So what we're going to do this time is we're going to finish what we started last week, which was to talk about critical thinking and, in particular, the informal fallacies that occur when we think uncritically. And so we're going to do a review of what we did last week, and then we're going to finish up because I promise I'm going to finish. Famous last words, but this time I'm actually going to keep the promise because we can't drag this on forever. So one of the things that we talked about last week was, what are the kinds of things that stop us from thinking well, from thinking effectively?
Emotions?
Emotions, sure. Ross? So our ego inhibits our ability to hear.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, please, Helen.
Biases.
Our biases. And then we listed a whole bunch of biases that we have last time. And one of the things that we talked about last time, we saw a very brief video with Greg Kokel, who was describing an interchange he had with Christopher Hitchens. And I mentioned that Christopher Hitchens is one of the best, or was one of the best, the late Christopher Hitchens, I should call him now, was one of the best rhetoricians when it came to engaging people. He was a very effective atheist, very hostile to religion in general, very hostile to a lot of things, actually. And so somebody had asked me, well, should we see some of Christopher Hitchens' arguments and then work on them here? And I think it was Al. Is Al here, the class atheist? Welcome, Al. That's what I'm going to answer right now. The answer is no, I did not. And here is why. Hold on. Do not fire any flares into the air. This ship is not sinking. The reason I did not, Al, and for the rest of the group too, because I told you I wanted to bring them, was this week I looked at a whole bunch of Christopher Hitchens' work. And many of his videos reflected a similarity. And here's the bottom line, is that the reason I didn't bring those videos and didn't bring them to show, even short ones, some of them as short as 2 or 3 minutes, was that when I was analyzing them, I said, oh my goodness, these are going to take forever to get through. A 3-minute video could get you easily an hour's worth of analysis. But they're really perfect in explaining some of the problems that we as Christians face when we're talking to people who aren't Christians. Because one of the things that happens is that people who are not Christians, or even some Christians who have different ways of thinking about things, say the difference between a young earth or an old earth person, sometimes those two parties or groups will talk to each other in ways that aren't necessarily respectable. Or they talk past each other. And so in order to analyze those kinds of things, we need to spend time to understand what is it that is being miscommunicated and how. And is there a defect in the reasoning? Well, with Christopher Hitchens, I found 3 things that he does all the time. And he does it so much and so well that it's almost impossible for somebody who's trying to act reasonably to deal with him. So one of the things that he does is he equivocates. And equivocating means you use one word in several different ways and pretend it means one thing, but you're really using it a bunch of different ways. Another thing he does, and he's very, very good at it, is he will interrupt other people while they're talking. and distract them from where they're going. That's a really great rhetorical device. It's really good. And then the last thing he does is he will distract using a red herring. He'll just throw something off that has nothing to do with what you're talking about. Or he'll make a straw man. He'll create an argument that looks like your argument and then beat it up and make it look like he beat up your argument. So that's actually four things. There are even more than that. Well, there's all sorts of non sequiturs. Just about every fallacy ends up being a non sequitur. So non sequitur is a bigger category of things that it really means doesn't follow. Yes, please.
Mark, does he have any actual arguments against faith, or is it all just rhetorical devices and cheats that he uses?
Oh, he has some real arguments. Yeah, he does. He's not completely vacant. It's not an empty set with this guy. But what's interesting is, for example, I was watching one of his arguments about the Old Testament, and he picks and chooses sections out of it and then puts them together as he would like to see them put, and then remarks about them in ways that are inappropriate. In other words, he's extracting them from context and then not explaining them to them in context. So, there's just a lot of stuff. If you want to look at all the rules of cheating in debate, he's the one who wrote the book. So, I mean, that is very harsh. And I don't mean to beat up on somebody who's dead. That's not my job. But I do need to be honest about what Christopher Hitchens did and why I did not bring videos of him today. So in church, I was talking to Carol about that. And Carol said, well, that sounds like a lesson for another time. And I said, it does. I think what we'll do on another time is we'll have some Christopher Hitchens stuff up there. Run it. Just let it go for itself, 2 or 3 minutes at a time. Stop, and then analyze what he just did. But today we don't. So that's a long way of getting around why I don't have one of his videos. All right, so last time we asked, what is an argument? What is an argument?
A claim.
Good. A claim with what?
Counterclaim.
A claim is an argument. An argument is a claim supported by reasons and evidence. Then we went through what the elements of an argument were. We saw a video. And you know what? I'm going to play this video just because I want to make sure the sound works. Interesting, even the video isn't working.
Oh, pinch.
Severe pinch.
Yeah, you and Alice.
Explicitly now, an argument is something very particular, and it isn't just an opinion. If you say there is no God, that's not an argument. That's a point of view. It might be a conclusion if you have reasons that led you to that point. Think of an argument like a house. House has got a roof, and it's got walls that support the roof. If the walls are strong and sturdy, then the roof is supported. If they're not, the roof falls down. An argument is like that. The roof would be the point of view. There is no God. Now, what supports that conclusion? That is, what is the evidence? What are the reasons? Whatever. What are the walls? The walls are the supporting evidences. What make up the argument? And in any given argument, you have to figure out what those two things are. The point of view, what do you mean by that? Remember that from earlier today? And the reasons for the point of view, how did you come to that conclusion? So whenever you encounter a challenge, you can break the challenge down. Whether it comes in a book or whether it comes on a TV show or just somebody having a conversation with you, you break it down. And you try to focus in on exactly what is the person claiming to be so, and what precisely are their reasons that they believe it is so. Once you get the argument in front of you, then you can look at it. Christians hear a person like Christopher Hitchens, and he goes on and on and rattles and this and that and the other thing, and they get really nervous and upset and scared. Because nobody's scared.
Just listen to what he says. No, you might have to get a tape recorder. You might have to outline his book or something. It might take a while to separate the wheat from chaff, the nonsense from the real argument. Get the real argument in front of you, though. And when you do, then you'll have an opportunity to examine it. So clear the brush, then ask about the house. What is the argument? What are the reasons for the point of view? Now, Christopher Hitchens, a month or so ago, debated a friend of mine, J. Wesley Richards. He wrote the book The Privileged Planet, which is a very, and there's a DVD that goes with it. It's a very, very powerful argument for the existence of God based on cosmology and design. It's superb. It's the best thing going. If you want one single thing, you take, get this DVD, you just pop it into your television, and you push the button, and you have your prejudices in on it, just watch it, and then talk with them about it later. It's really sensational. Anyway, so here's J. Richards, who is the Christian theist, and there's Christopher Hitchens. And Hitchens gets up first, and Hitchens does his number with all his nonsense and his ideas, and he's throwing all this stuff up. But Jay has this turn, he's starting to talk, and then he's talking for a little while, and Hitchens interrupts him. And Hitchens makes this point, I think we have a slide for this. Hitchens says, do you believe that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin? Do you believe that he resurrected from the dead? Now he's interrupted, my friend, Jay Richards. So Jay, stops. He says, well, yeah, I do believe in the virgin birth, and I do believe in the resurrection. And Hitchens says, I rest my case. He's sitting there. I rest my case. This is an honest guy who has just made it very clear that science has nothing to do with his worldview. Now, this is rhetorically powerful. It's clever. But here's my question. You just said you rested your case. What case would that be?
Okay, now I know the video works.
Yep.
Good. We were making a comparison last time about theology and rhetoric or discourse. And we put up here orthodoxy, orthopraxy, orthopathy as being the elements of a whole theology. Do you remember what we meant by those three words? What's an orthodoxy?
A right belief.
Yes, a right belief. What is orthopraxy?
Practice.
The right practice.
Right practice.
And orthopathy?
Passions.
The right passions, the right sentiments, emotions, approaching it the proper way emotionally. In discourse, there are some very interesting similarities. Orthodoxy brings us into our minds. Okay, that's where we're interpreting and understanding scriptures. The elements of the whole discourse starts with logos. Logos is the root word of logic. It's the root word of a lot of things. And what that's talking about is the structure or the content of what we're saying. The next one is ethos. Ethos is more like who you are, your ethos. So if I am a criminal and I'm talking to you, I have one ethos. If I'm a Christian or I'm believable, I have another ethos. Yes, please.
Is that the root?
Yes. Ethos is the root word for ethics. Pathos. Pathos. What do you think that comes in a discourse? So somebody said emotions? Yes. Your emotions. What is something that's pathetic? Something that evokes pity or passions? Sure. And when you read a book and you say that this thing had a lot of pathos, or see a movie, it's had a lot of pathos. What are we talking about there? We're talking about it affecting our spirits. Go ahead.
The opposite of apathy.
That's right. Good. Thank you. The opposite of apathy. Apathy means we don't have any sentiments at all. So when you put these together, the elements of a whole discourse is what we are doing when we are conveying our thoughts or engaging in discourse with another person. It is who we are, the ethos. It is what we're conveying and the structure of what we're conveying, which is the logos. And then it is the sentiment. Are we conveying the right sentiment? We'll get past that. What is a fallacy? It says right on the board here. What do you, help me out with that. It's a mistaken reasoning. First of all, it's a mistaken reasoning. And what about this mistaken reasoning makes it uniquely a fallacy? Well, they don't often look like mistakes. There are formal fallacies. Those are ones that are the form or structure of logic. So if you defy a law of logic, that's a formal fallacy. But if you defy the laws of reasoning that don't have anything to do with logic proper, then that's an informal fallacy. It says an informal fallacy is an argument where real-world content matters. In formal logic, you can use nothing but symbols. It's very much like arithmetic or mathematics. So these variables can count for anything. But when you come to informal reasoning, it's all about the language. How is the language used? So the structure is not relevant. We talked about factoids, some of the things that are interesting that people don't really think about when they're thinking about fallacies. One of them that's really important is that there are not all fallacies have names. So what I don't want you to think of, or what I don't want you to believe, is that the fallacies that we're going to be discussing today is an exhaustive list. It isn't. First of all, there's about 300 cataloged. And then there are many, many more fallacies that occur in natural language that don't have names to them, but you can put names to them if you want. But they aren't named. And there's no end to that. Why? Because there's no end to the way you can manipulate the language. Some of the informal fallacies are logically valid, like circular reasoning. And we'll get into that. I'm going to give you an example of circular reasoning and show you exactly why it is that that's logically valid but informally fallacious. And then some formally valid arguments can be real-world nonsense. Remember last time I talked to you and I said, in logic, if you're doing a symbolic logic in any one of the different calculi that they have, if you put A and not A, and then you make a conclusion, you can conclude anything whatsoever if one premise exists and its contradiction exists in the same argument. Now, we shake our heads at that. So that's nonsense. That's ridiculous. Well, yes, it's as ridiculous as the square root of a negative number. But it comes out with an imaginary number, and it's manipulable within the arithmetic or the mathematics. The same thing occurs in logic. There are things that you can do in logic that just don't make any sense at all in real-world language. That's why we don't worry about informal fallacies when we're dealing with informal fallacies, because it's too difficult to wrap your head around. And once you do, then you realize, gosh, I didn't really need to know that. Did we go through the example of unqualified expert last time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's an unqualified expert? Somebody who's arguing or somebody who's being appealed to who's saying something that's beyond this field. Thank you. So an appeal to an authority in one field for expert opinion outside of their field. All right, what does it take to be a qualified expert? Okay, that's some of that. We talked about Hugh Ross being arguably an unqualified expert in certain areas. And then we said, well, wait a minute, is he really? I mean, he has a PhD in astronomy, but he talks about biology, and he talks about anthropology, and he talks about some other stuff in quite an expert way. So why would appeal to him, or would appeal to him for certain kinds of things like the stuff he's written in books? Would that be an appeal to unqualified authority because he doesn't have a PhD in those other disciplines? Dan?
The credentials that you have.
Well, credentials certainly help, but what about study outside of credentials? Is it possible to study something and get expertise in it without getting a degree?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
He's
been studying for 3 years and his best friend qualified as an example.
Yes. So we have to be careful when we talk about an unqualified expert. We do need to know what it is that somebody, if we're going to appeal to somebody or somebody else is going to appeal to someone as an expert, We need to know what their background is. And we need to also understand just because they don't have a PhD or a master's or a graduate degree or whatever, doesn't mean they don't know. They may be very, very knowledgeable and may indeed be an expert without having any degree whatsoever. Yes, please.
Also, just for that point, he's making our points. He may have sufficiently made himself qualified.
Sure, but independent study for nothing else. Sure. Thank you. Let's get into the next fallacy, which is the is-ought fallacy, or the difference between description and prescription. And it looks something like an assumption that because something is currently practiced, it should be practiced. So let me give you an example. It's a fact that people naturally have premarital sex, so religious people ought to just accept it and stop being so uptight.
That's a fallacy.
That is a fallacy. Yes, it is a fallacy. It's the is-ought fallacy. And it is as if because it's being done, then it ought to be done. In other words, it takes from a description of what's going on to prescribing that it ought to continue going on. It occurs a lot in law. It's a very common appeal when people say, well, it's law, it's legal, so it must be right. Well, all you have to do is ask the question about abortion, and then, well, you have a conflict there. So the is-ought fallacy is easy to mistake for real reasoning because it has the appearance of it. If I say, well, the law says it's right, so it must be okay. Yes, please.
Does this work the same as the fallacy of the appeal to tradition? We've always done things this way, so we should continue doing it this way?
They're related, but they're not identical. You have a very good way of integrating those things. They are related, but they are the same. And we will get to fallacies of popular fallacies and then the fallacies to tradition, which is an ab annus fallacy. But we will get into that here.
So would that possibly be more like a... when you're arguing on the practice of something versus this would be like how right something is, like its actual value on its own as opposed to its practice?
Well, what we're talking about, the is-ought fallacy, is a practice is occurring. And then we're assuming that because it's occurring and because it's widespread, that it is also right. That's where we get the ought from. So it ought to be done because it is done. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah.
Good, thank you. Same thing with the drugs. You know, people have used recreational drugs throughout history. We ought to quit trying to outlaw them. You can see
the way it's going, isn't it?
Well, it does seem to be the way it's going. So you can really get a clear view of what the problem is when you start applying it through law. That's probably the most conspicuous place where it's misused, where the fallacy occurs. Go ahead.
It would be easy to beat that fallacy by turning it around. You could say, well, if someone's arguing for drugs in that example, you could say, well, people have been murdering each other forever, so murder should be legal. You agree with that. It's the same logic, and yet they wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because you start getting into problems of analogy there, and I think your analogy is good. And we're going to talk about a slippery slope argument here in a little while. But arguments to analogy are difficult for people to manipulate. They're difficult for people to engage. So if I were going to respond to that, I'd say, well, murder is of a different class than drug use. And so so in some respects, you're absolutely right. But you're using a rhetorical device to try and undermine their argument. So, yeah, good. Very good. Thank you. Jamie.
I thought her question probably might have to do with more of a thing, maybe an ontological thing. Something such as there's an argument that a person might be born a certain way,
mm-hmm.
or with a certain predilection to do certain behaviors, and therefore they ought to pursue those behaviors.
Okay, so the question is, if somebody is born a certain way, then they ought to continue doing what they're doing, or they ought to do what they're doing because it's natural for them? Is that the argument? Okay, this works differently from that. Yeah, it's a different kind of thing, because what you're talking about there is a very particular person, and then you're asking the question, should that person ought to do what they're doing? What we're talking about here is a set of practices. So the is ought is a description prescription problem. I'm describing a practice, saying, well, this is what the practice is. It's widespread, and therefore we prescribe it. We're going to say that's what everybody's going to do, or everybody ought to do it. It's different than an individual, because now an individual is not, an individual has his own particular properties, and that property isn't a set of practices over a wide group of people. Do you see the difference?
I just, there was his ought, it's just about practice.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a version of what's called a genetic fallacy that applies to that, although the genetic fallacy description is usually very different. But one of the genetic fallacies is exactly what you're talking about. This person is this way, this originates that way, therefore everything that follows from it is perfectly fine. But that's a very small sliver of the genetic fallacy, and we're going to talk about the more broadly used one. Was that responsive to your question? Thank you. Wishful thinking. If ever there was a fallacy that occurs in science, that occurs more often than any other, this is it. Yes, we get to watch how. So a wishful thinking fallacy is one where you make an assumption without good evidence that because one wants something to be true, it is true. Well, how does that work in science? How in the world can I say that about science? Hold on now. Look at these two examples. The first one is, we do not yet have a naturalistic answer to the origin of life, but we know eventually science will find it. Well, do I have the evidence in my hand to make that true? No, I don't. And you'll see in blue text there, it says, this is also an ad futuris fallacy. There are times when fallacies or a particular statement can have more than one fallacy apply to it. And this is one of them. Look at the next one here. It's the same form. We haven't found the neuronal correlates to consciousness yet, but the history of science tells us that even the most difficult mysteries can be scientifically explained. I wish that were true if I'm a scientist. But is it true? No, I can't wish it to be so. I either have the evidence or I don't have the evidence. Please.
There's another form it takes in science. It's, if we find water on Mars, maybe we'll find life. That's just as wishful thinking, because they're jumping 48,000 steps.
Yes. Yes, very much so. So let's go back to the definition. An assumption without good evidence. Good evidence. It doesn't mean it has to be conclusive. It just has to be not good. So when we look at these two examples of origin of life and trying to determine the nature of consciousness, do we have good answers to those questions, scientific answers? And the answer is absolutely not. We do not know the scientific origin of life. There is no naturalistic explanation. There's all sorts of interesting myths and theories and ideas, but we don't know them. And so to say that in the future we will eventually know it, or we will eventually come to it, is a wish. It isn't evidence.
Well, it's a faith statement.
It's a faith statement, yes. And faith that's not a Christian faith, for example, is very often wishful thinking. And we distinguish a Christian faith from other faiths in that we don't wish God were there. We don't wish Jesus is the Christ. We don't wish salvation. We have evidence for it. Jesus Christ did miracles. Historicity of Christ is well documented. All sorts of evidence that we have for Christ and for Christianity isn't wishful thinking. It's empirical. Go ahead.
I'm going to say on number one, that's a two-pronged faith. Yeah, we might find out that creation isn't true, but also science is discovering right now that the biblical account of a lot of this stuff is accurate.
Well, that's true, too. Well, I'm not disputing that, and I don't want to get into the evidence for why the origin of life isn't going to be natural. That's a different question, and that's a whole day's worth of work. What I'm trying to get at here is that this is a very particular kind of fallacy. And it's also, you see up here it says ad futuris. It's a belief that in the future something is going to happen for which you don't have evidence today. They're both very similar. One, I wish it to be true. The other one, I declare it to be true because in the past it's looked like that. So ad futuris is in the future, eventually science will make us immortal. That's an ad futuris fallacy. Because we don't own the future, we don't have the evidence of the future, therefore we can't claim that as a truth. I'm going to start from the right and move my way to the left. So you first, and then I'll get to Al.
So I was wondering, could a non-Christian possibly cite this fallacy when talking to, when we're sharing about our faith and about how, because of our belief in God, that we have experienced these sort of like emotional highs and lows, but could they argue that it's wishful thinking that because we want God to exist that we feel these things? Or possibly could they argue, like when talking about the afterlife, like we have this faith, we believe that something certain will happen to us after we die, but since, as far as I know, we don't have any empirical data of what happens after you die, that could they say that we're using an ad futuris fallacy?
Very good question. So the question is, could a person who disagrees with Christianity argue that we're deploying an ad futuris fallacy by saying, well, in the future, we're going to go to heaven? What do you think?
They do it all the time.
Well, they say it all the time, but is it a fallacy? Okay, say it again, Mara. We have some evidence. So let's go back here. An assumption without good evidence that because someone wants something to be true, it is true. All right, I want it to be true that when I die, I go to be with Christ. Okay? So, am I assuming that merely because I wish it to be so? Well, if you were to ask me, I would say no. I have some evidence for why I believe what I believe. So it is not merely a wish or I want something to be true. I don't just want to go to heaven. Although I do, I don't merely want it. I have evidence for it. So that's what takes me out of the wishful thinking fallacy.
So if someone tries to cite that, like if they try to cut you off and say you're using wishful thinking fallacy, could you just say, give me a moment, I'll give you the evidence for my argument?
Exactly. So the question is, if someone is going to pose to me or claim that I'm having the wishful thinking fallacy, I would say, no, just a moment, let me give you the evidence. That completely reverses it. So you're absolutely right. You can show that you're not deploying the fallacy when you have evidence, good evidence, that it's not merely a wish. And that's where wishful thinking is. It's merely a wish. It's an assumption without good evidence, so it's merely a wish.
That's the reason for this class.
Yes, that's right. We have reasons to believe. Al?
Reasons to believe.
I think all religions are founded on wishful thinking because it's fake. They have nobody knows what's in the afterlife or after we die. Nobody, and no evidence has ever been proven that man survives the grave. So it's full of wishful thinking.
Well, let's I'm just going to give you one half a minute's worth of evidence here, Al. If I walked up to you and said, "Follow me, Al," and I took you to a shooting range and I let somebody put bullets in me and killed me, and then you said, "Dang, that was pretty stupid." And then I got up, said, "Hi, Al. I went to the dead, and I hung out there for about a couple of minutes, and here's what it's like." And then I start laying out what it's like to be alive after you're dead. And then I take you back 2,000 years, and I take you to another guy whose name is Jesus, who gets stuck on a cross, and they shank him with a sword to prove that he's dead. He's dead for a couple of days, and he comes back to life, and he starts talking to people.
How does he describe heaven? Other than my father, there's many mansions.
Well, any description whatsoever or a claim that he was there and that there is a heaven is sufficient. He doesn't have to exhaustively detail it any more than you can exhaustively detail Earth.
No, Billy Graham did
detailed it.
Oh, well, okay. Well, I'm not going to get into that. The point that I'm getting at is that it isn't wishful thinking to believe that when there is evidence to be there. If you want to contest the evidence, I get you, and that's okay. But don't call it wishful thinking when they do have reasonable evidence. Okay, we're done with that, Al. Okay, I have to move on because we only have a half hour and I've got a ton of stuff to cover, and I promised you I'd finish. That is wishful thinking of me to make that promise. Very well said. Very well said. Okay. So we talked about tradition and can you appeal tradition and what is that about? Well, there's an argument or a fallacy called time snobbery or ab annus, where you're looking at time as something that is new and modern, is superior to what is old. Okay, that's kind of the reverse of what you mentioned earlier, but we'll get into that. And so an argument would look like something like this. We need to just get past all this ancient religious stuff. This is the 21st century. We were liberated from the moral prison of the ancients. Okay? All right. Well, what does being in the 21st century have to do with the truth or falsity of a religion? Nothing. It's irrelevant. It is irrelevant. This is a fallacy of relevance, by the way. Look at number two. Human nature has evolved. Modern thinking creates a better world than our grandparents ever dreamed of. We have nothing to learn from our ancestors' obsolete thinking. Really?
That's a fallacy.
That's a fallacy, too. Because it doesn't show evidence for why our thinking is better than the ancients. Now, one more. And this is what you were talking about earlier. And a variant of this is to say that in the past, the world was a better place than the current. You know, you hear people say, well, in the old days, you know, we were better people. We were smarter than these kids today. These kids today are just airheads. You know, they don't have a computer in front of them. They don't know anything. Well, that's not true. But that's another variant of the time snobbery or ab annus fallacy. This one, the loaded question, is a really fun one because you'll see this done a lot in politics. It's one of my favorites to watch because it's so entertaining. A question that presumes the answer to an unasked question. And let's look at a video here and see it.
Even our best friends can be jerks sometimes. Let's say you get a bad grade in a class, and your snarky friend says, have you stopped cheating on tests? Of course, you probably wouldn't say no, which would imply you cheated on your most recent test. But if you were to simply answer yes, you would be implying that you most likely cheated on tests in the past. No matter what you say, it sounds like you've been cheating. Such interrogatives are known as complex or loaded questions, which are questions based on falsehoods or unfounded presumptions. Loaded questions are a type of logical fallacy, a faulty course of reasoning. In the case of loaded questions, the interrogator's logic is flawed when he or she poses a question that is grounded in something that is speculative at best or patently untrue. Take, for instance, have you stopped cheating on tests? The logical fallacy here is founded on the probably false assertion or assumption that you have been cheating on tests, most likely sometime in the recent past. Questions like these are dangerous not only because they're based in falsehood, but because they're also typically answerable only by yes or no. This presents a problem since these are known as complex questions because they commonly consist of multiple questions in one. Thus, their common Latin designation, Plurium interrogationum, meaning from
you got that
question.
Memorize that.
Looking again to the cheating question, maybe you never cheated on a test, so you want to say no, but that simple answer isn't enough. You would have to say no, I never cheated on any of my tests. Say, however, you did answer yes. You might then go on to explain that you stopped cheating on tests, but you only did it once and it was a long time ago. In both cases, you had to add extra explanations. As rhetorical devices, then, complex questions are tools that can be used to kill debates by baiting opponents into incriminating or otherwise unflattering positions. Similarly, political debaters and critics will pose loaded questions for the purpose of luring their targets into compromising scenarios, even if the person refuses to answer the question, a common antidote, or offers information for the answer. The individual still runs the chance of losing credibility if not handled expertly.
So this is the kind of thing that a complex question looks like. Have you stopped beating your husband? Okay, well, there's some tough women in here, so I wanted to make sure this was about women, not about just men beating their wives, but this is the 21st century. And when are you anti-scientific creationists going to stop pretending there's a God? Do you see how the question is loaded? That no matter what you say to it, you've either assented to the fact that you've been beating your husband, and I hope you haven't. Please don't do it. If you stop doing it, if you're doing it now. Or that you're an anti-scientific creationist. So that's a complex question. It's more often referred to as a loaded question, but if you hear complex question or loaded question, that they mean the same thing.
Actually, you think of it, even if you give a good answer to those questions, there's an implication that you are trying to justify something and you're trying to hide something, that you're making excuses.
Right. Yeah, the trick or the device used in the loaded question fallacy is that it plants in the minds of the hearers that it may be true. And if you don't categorically say that is not true, then you've left it out as possibility. Or worse, you say yes or no to it, in which case you've assented to it. And what the problem here is that it's unfair because it merely makes the allegation, and you have to clear up in the mind of the people who are hearing it. Not only is the allegation false, but there was something wrong with a person to make an allegation that he knew was false.
And it's accusatory.
Absolutely, he's accusatory.
Terrible.
Yes, please.
It's really difficult if you're like me and then you're on a witness stand and then the lawyer tells you you can only answer the question with yes, no, and
no.
I've been in that situation with bad lawyers, and I very quickly learned that I would just say I can't answer that question because the question has errors in it. And boy, did that lawyer. The lawyer got so frustrated because that was all I would answer. Because the only questions he answered, he finally lost his cool, which was great. Bonnie just said, okay, just tell me your story, which was not what he wanted.
I'm surprised they let you object on the stand.
Well, you can just, yes, I mean, that's the best answer I've come up with, is just to put it back on the other person and say, I can't answer that question because it has errors. Ask me a question that doesn't have answers, and it puts it back on the other person and immediately stops it.
Okay, I'm there.
So,
go ahead.
So in terms of the language used, how is this different from rhetorical questions? Because rhetorical questions seem to sort of like, they have this unanswerable quality to them, but you wouldn't really use a rhetorical question in a debate, would you?
Well, you could. A rhetorical question is a question that's posed where you expect the audience to already know the answer.
Right. But you can't assume that they would know the answer in a debate that has two different sides, right?
True. But I could say something like, as a rhetorical question, would anybody think it's okay to stick needles in babies' eyes? Okay, I mean, that's terrible. So the answer is obviously no. No, so it's a rhetorical question. So that I would use that to start the basis of an argument about morals and how to treat children. Okay, sorry for the really terrible thing there. But it did make my point, all puns intended. Yeah.
So if someone was going to take a rhetorical question like that and turn it into a loaded question, would it have sort of an ad hominem effect to it? Like asking the question, so you're saying you're totally okay with sticking needles into baby's eyes. Would that then turn it into a loaded question?
I'm going to help me with that one. Try to say that again. I didn't quite get how you're phrasing that.
Yeah, I guess kind of like phrasing it into that kind of a form of a question. I'm just curious how the two kind of work together. Or
which two are you talking about now?
Rhetorical questions versus loaded questions.
Okay, a rhetorical question doesn't imply anything about the hearer.
Right.
So I can just ask a question and then we all know the answer. Whereas the loaded question is an affront to you. I'm making an accusation against you. And the only way you can answer it, and attaching it to another question, and the only way you can answer the part that really is in the open is to say yes to whatever the bad thing is. So in this one here, this is not a rhetorical question. This is exclusively a complex question. Okay? So have you stopped beating your husband? Okay, it presumes that you're beating your husband. There's no presumption in a rhetorical question. There's only an understanding that everybody knows the answer. But there's no allegation. There's no claim that you're a particular thing, a husband beater or anything like that. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does that respond to your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We are going to get into a little bit more of what you mentioned, though. So stay tuned. Don't touch that radio dial. We touched on one version of the genetic fallacy, and I don't want to get into that much more because it's a little bit more complicated. But the genetic fallacy is the fallacy in which we believe that because something had a bad origin or some not such a good origin, an origin that was somehow bad to our morals or our ideals, that everything that flowed from it is necessarily bad. And that's not true. That isn't necessarily true. So evaluating a later practice as if it were the same as the original practice, ignoring changes made in an intervening period. And I'm going to give you some examples here. These are pretty easy to see. So Halloween originated in the ancient pagan rituals. Therefore, we should not allow our children to participate in Halloween.
Well, what's all about?
Well, was there a difference? Have things changed from the time they originated to the time that kids are going around with masks on their head and asking for candy? Is there a difference? Yes, there is. There is. Same thing with birthday candles. If birthday candles originated as part of the moon goddess ritual, where they made cakes and sacrificed them to the moon goddess and then put candles on those cakes, and that actually was the origin of it, I mean, that's where it came from, then should we stop using candles on birthday cakes now because that was originally something that was handed over to Artemis?
Not necessarily.
So a lot happened between the pagan world and our world today, and children today don't know anything about what happened 2,500 years ago. So there's
time snobbery.
Time snobbery. Well, that sounds good too. Yes, please.
So time parenthood should not be related to Margaret Sanger.
Well, that's an interesting question. So the question was, so Planned Parenthood should not be related to Margaret Sanger. Well, the way that question is formed, the answer is yes, they should be. But what would make that a genetic fallacy is Margaret Sanger was believed to be and made some very, very racist comments, and that her whole purpose, or part of her purpose, I should say, I don't want to overstate it, part of her purpose was to eliminate certain groups, particularly persons of color. Well, can you say the same thing of Planned Parenthood today? Are they following the same edicts that Margaret Sanger came up with? Probably not. I think they're probably more interested in making money than they are in satisfying some kind of racial problem. But you're getting at an interesting point there. Is at somewhere along the road, you've got to be able to make the connection in order for it to not be a fallacy. But if you can't make a connection, in other words, if you can say that, you know, this origin led up to where we are today, and there's a continuation and we're still adopting those same tenets, then you don't have the fallacy. Okay.
What about saying certain things about disabled people?
The same thing would apply. The same thing would apply. We don't get to say bad things about disabled people. Disabled people are good people just like anybody else, and we don't worry about what color they are, or whether they can see or hear or anything. Does that answer your question, Steve?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, so the slippery slope fallacy, we've said it before, we've used the term, but what does it really mean, and how do you really use it? Well, here's how it works, and it's important to make sure that you catch this first clause. Without good causal evidence, assuming that an event is the first in a series that will result in bad consequences. without good causal evidence. That is the key to this fallacy. I'm going to show you an example of one. And the little boy in this example was me. And you'll see why in a minute.
The Acme Fox Company
Wrong one.
A corporate meeting of its regional managers. The managers want to let the employees include more personal items in their work area. Right now, no one is allowed to put up photos of loved ones. Only work-related documents can be posted in cubicles. The other issue on the table is use of the internet during work hours. The regional managers want to allow employees to use the internet for certain types of research and on their breaks. The owner of the company is absolutely against these changes. She says that if they make the adjustment to allow use of the internet, their productivity will go down to the point where the company won't be profitable anymore. We'll go out of business, she says. She also says that the inclusion of photos of family and friends could evolve into the posting of inappropriate images on cubicle walls. We'll get sued, she says. In this lesson, you'll consider whether the owner of the company has a reason to argue this way, or if she is relying on a slippery slope fallacy. The slippery slope fallacy is an argument that claims that if one thing happens, or is allowed to happen, then that will lead to other steps, and ultimately to a final outcome. In other words, if the first thing happens, then the last thing is inevitable. If written out as a formula, the slippery slope fallacy would say, if we allow A, then B, C, D, and E will occur. So A will ultimately cause E to happen. If you imagine a person at the top of an icy, slippery mountainside, the slippery slope fallacy suggests that once they find themselves at point A, it's only a matter of time until they slide down the whole slope and end up at point E. In the case of the Acme Box Company, the owner argues that use of the internet will lead to a bankrupt company. The managers protest, saying that they only want to have employees use the internet for a small portion of their time. The owner says to them, "That's just the start. Soon they'll be using it more than for those limited purposes and will start to use it for other reasons. They'll start to spend time on the internet doing non-work-related activities when they should be working. From there, they'll increase this to the point where there's so little work getting done that our profits will go down the drain." The managers argue that they have ways of monitoring the use of the internet and ensuring it is only used properly. But the owner holds her argument, saying that the moment they allow use of the internet, it's a slippery slope down to the point where the company goes out of business.
So in that case, the business owner was saying, well, if they use the internet, we're going to go out of business. If we allow them to put pictures up, it's going to corrupt the agency. Can't do it. And their, the counter-argument to that was the ones that they were giving in the little vignette. Go ahead.
Are we as Christians making the slippery slope fallacy when we say that gay marriage will eventually turn into marrying your dog or whatever? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that is an argument. There is an argument that it's a slippery slope fallacy to say that all of these other things are going to occur if gay marriage occurs. So the question is, is it a fallacy if you can link causally the first step to the step that you're saying is the conclusion? If you can say, well, this will cause this, this will cause that, and you have a good causal model for each one of those, then no, it is not a slippery slope. But if you're just asserting it without any show of causal model between the different so-called steps that are going to occur, then it's a fallacy. Then it can be argued as a fallacy.
Well, to me, the key word in that video was the word inevitable. It's almost impossible to prove anything is inevitable.
That's true.
And so it's more like an appeal to human nature, in this case, the gay marriage argument or whatever. And that's just probabilities. So can you use probability as a slippery slope argument?
You can, but then you start asking the question, how probable is probable enough? And so there you have to describe is the causal model that starts with the origin sufficient to justify the prediction?
Five sigma.
Okay. If you can get to five sigma, then you're all right. But so the important thing here in slippery slope is to recognize that when it's done ordinarily, people just envision this terrible consequence but don't have a good model to describe how it's going to occur. And I've got to keep going. I can't answer any more questions right now. I know people are really want to ask some questions, but I've got to get through this or Dave will fire me. Okay. So an appeal to popular opinion. Now, this gets used all the time. All the time. This is one of the most popular fallacies you're going to see. And it's an assumption that a proposition is true because most or many people believe it's true. So an increasing majority of Americans support same-sex marriages, so all churches should realize that same-sex marriage is no longer immoral, etc. That just because 1,000 people believe it's true, does that really mean it's true?
No.
So let's see if my little robot friends here are going to help us.
Some people say I'm an egg. Do you think I'm an egg?
Your egg is an empty box. Why should people call you anything else?
So when so many people say I'm an egg, that means I'm an egg.
You're an egghead whether 1,000 people call you one or not.
Well, then, if 1,000 people call me an egg, and I really am an egg, then it shows that whatever large numbers of people say must be true.
No, this is a fallacy. It's called the appeal to the people, or unpopular fallacy. It doesn't matter how many people say it's true. They can all be wrong. All right. A large number of people making a claim doesn't make it false claim. True or a true claim. False.
Why is that? How can so many people be wrong?
If 100 people believe 2 plus 2 is 8, would that make it true?
No. That's silly.
If 300 people believed it to be so, would that make it true?
That's even more silly. So no matter if everyone says I'm an airhead or not, I'm an airhead no matter what they say.
Yes, that's right. And you all proved that even an airhead can learn the unpopular fallacy.
See, that was my first venture into cartooning. I had to, that was my design there. Okay, circular reasoning is asserting an argument's conclusion as the argument's premise. It's begging the question. This is the one that I think you do not want to show with your children. Do not show this to your children.
10-year-old Colby is playing video games when his mother comes in and says, "It's time to go." They have errands to run, and she doesn't want to leave him home alone. When he asks why he can't stay home, she uses the phrase many parents know well. "Because I'm your mother, and I said so." But Colby isn't your typical 10-year-old. He's a philosophy genius. And he's going to give his mom a hard time about what she just said. "Mom, that's begging the question. That's a philosophical fallacy, a faulty argument." Her first reaction is to just angrily repeat what she said, but he's struck her curiosity. Colby's mom asks him to explain what he means before they head out to do the errands. By the end of this lesson, you'll know the characteristics of this fallacy, and you'll be able to identify arguments that use it. Colby explains to his mom, "When I asked you for reasons why I can't stay home on my own, you said it was because you said I couldn't. So you were telling me I can't stay home because you say I can't stay home. You didn't give good evidence for why I should listen to what you're telling me to do." His mom has to stop herself from getting angry with Colby. She says, "But the reason I say it like that is because it's obviously true. You have to believe me because what I tell you is the truth." There you go again, Mom. That's a type of circular reasoning. Starting one's argument with the conclusion to the argument. It doesn't give evidence at all. His mom is reaching her limit for her son's philosophical arguments. But she's still intrigued. She asks, "Tell me more about what you mean." Colby explains that in any argument, you start with a premise or a theory, and then must give evidence to prove that theory and draw conclusions. He goes back to their conversation. For instance, when you said that I must do what you tell me to do, the next step would be to give evidence for why this is true. But when a person uses evidence that is just restating their claim, it's known as begging the question. A form of circular reasoning, this is an argument with a conclusion that appears as one of its premises. This is how people typically make a faulty argument by begging the question. He writes on his mini chalkboard, X is true. The evidence for this is X. A person starts off by stating that a certain thing is true. Then they do not give any real evidence for that. Instead, they restate the same general information. So no evidence is really given. No progress is made in the argument. A parent saying, you have to listen to me because I said you should listen to me, uses this fallacy. A better argument would be, X is true. The evidence for this is Y. Colby says to his mom that if she told him instead that the reason he must listen to her is because she has the responsibility to protect him from harm, that would be better evidence than because I said so.
So get in the car, I'm going to protect you from harm.
Okay, and here's some examples. I think that was a pretty clear little vignette. You know, of course he's a bachelor. Well, how do you know that? Because he's unmarried. Well, how do you know he's unmarried? Well, he's a bachelor. He just keep arguing in a circle. I'm going to go through these quickly because we are almost done here. A straw man is distorting or replacing another's argument to make it easier to defeat. And basically it amounts to something like, look at this, where a Christian says, Darwinian evolution is a failed theory, and the Darwinist says, sure, science is a big lie. Everything science does is bogus. All of science is a giant conspiracy. But what the Darwinian guy is saying is something completely different from what the Christian was saying. So he's setting up another argument and then beating up that one. The ad hominem is an argument in which you're attacking a particular person, and you're using it in a way that's an insult or a verbal attack in order to discredit or evade their argument. Christopher Hitchens uses this all the time. He uses ad hominem in very subtle ways. He's really remarkable at that. I've got to hand it to him. He's good. We have a video here, but that's going to take too much time. I want to make sure that we get to another one at the end here, which is the final words. This particular cartoon I put together so that we could see all of these and a couple more, because I knew we weren't going to have time for a long time to get this. So pay close attention to what they're saying, because what they're going to be doing is actually depicting the fallacies. Lights, please.
I don't even know why I'm here.
You're here because you're a dummy.
Why are you calling me a dummy?
Just look at the monitor. You're a dummy. You wouldn't know a fallacy if it hit you in the head.
That's stupid. You just have an inferiority complex.
That's an ad hominem fallacy.
Really? Well, what if I find 100 people and they all agree with me that you have an inferiority complex?
That's an ad hominem fallacy. The number of dummies who would agree with you is irrelevant.
You obviously either have an inferiority complex or you're a fool.
That's a false dilemma fallacy. It's also a fallacy of suppressed evidence. There are more than just the two options you stated, and you suppressed the evidence of those options in your claim.
I'm not claiming anything except what I'm rightfully entitled to claim on my income taxes.
That's a fallacy of equivocation. You're using the word claim as if it has only one meaning, but you're using it two different ways.
Does your inferiority complex always make you talk like this?
That's the fallacy of complex question. You presume an insult, then you embed it in a legitimate question. No matter whether I say yes or no, I'm still admitting to having an inferiority complex. I don't have an inferiority complex.
Stop denying you have an inferiority complex or I'll unscrew your head.
That's the appeal to false fallacy. You're using a threat to make me change the actions that flow from my claim.
I'm only trying to get you to see the truth. I can see you have a complex.
How do you know I have a complex?
Because I can see these kinds of things.
That's the fallacy of circular reasoning. You're not providing any evidence for your claim. You're just repeating it with different words and pretending that's evidence.
Can't you just accept what I'm saying? I've been hit many times, had my limbs torn off, and my head smashed. You should trust me.
That's an appeal to pity fallacy. Your claim is not true merely because you have a pathetic story.
I saw it in Russia where she said that people with injuries need to be heard and understood. She's famous. You've got to believe her.
That's an appeal to unqualified authority. She is an expert in getting women to watch her show. That doesn't qualify her to justify fallacious appeals to pity.
Well, you're not an authority either.
That's a red herring fallacy. You're changing the subject to something other than my argument. Just because I'm not an authority doesn't mean opera is an authority. My not being an authority is irrelevant.
Well, you can't prove Oprah's not an authority. So that proves she is an authority.
That's an argument from ignorance fallacy. Merely because something is not proved false does not prove that it's true.
Well, you're just a dummy, too.
That's the you too fallacy. Even if I am a dummy, that does not mean my argument is unsound. I'm tired of talking with you. I'm going to talk with someone intelligent, clever, witty, engaging, and humble. His name is Mark Perez.
Now that woman is not a dummy. Okay. With that, we're done. We are done. So thank you very much. Let me close us in prayer. Lord, thank you so much that we get a good time together and we get to see interesting things and learn things. I pray, Lord, that we'll be able to apply these things. There's a lot to we talked about today, but to the degree that we can use any of it for your glory, please help us to do it. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Have a wonderful
Thank you.